As you know, I collect antiquities and what Barry Humphreys rudely calls my broken rubble. But amongst them is a rock which is so much older than any of the others, millions of years older, and it's called a ventifact. It comes from one of the world's great deserts, not the Sahara, not the Nullarbor, but from the Antarctic. And it's a piece of stone that only the wind has acted upon, and it gives us a characteristic shape. Ventifacts look rather like a piece of an aeroplane wing with a fine edge on one side and a rounded shape on the other. Barry Owen Jones gave it to me, a souvenir from his days as minister responsible, and I couldn't help thinking about it when I was thinking about tonight's interview, because it's about Australia and its strong connection to the Antarctica. When the supercontinent of Gondwanaland began to split apart around 180 million years ago, Australia and the Antarctic were the last to split apart. And would you believe, fossils of marsupials and dinosaurs have been found in the Antarctic interior. So although we're typically seen as being on the bottom of the world, we know that there is an ice kingdom below us. Now, our connection has gone through many stages and variations, from early colonial hunting industries to scientific exploration and now conservation. And while the journey can now be done on a cruise ship or a plane ride, there is still nothing hospitable about the landscape, which can turn deadly on the turn of the wind. Joy McCann is an environmental historian who specialises in the cultural and natural history of the Southern Ocean and the Antarctica and its islands, and she's written a wonderful book about our relationship, and it's called Icebound, the Australian Story of Antarctica, and it's published by that fine outfit, the National Library. I welcome you to the program, Joy. First, tell us, and what drew you to the South, like so many before you?
Hello, Philip, and thanks for having me on the program. Well, I'm just as every other Australian who's ever read as a child about Antarctica and the Southern Ocean. I've been fascinated by the region. I grew up in Adelaide and used to spend my childhood trying to learn to swim in the Southern Ocean. And I used to look out to the sea and sort of imagine Antarctica and the icebergs floating in the ocean thousands of kilometres away. But it's not really until very recently that I've had the chance to actually travel into the Southern Ocean and as far as the Antarctic Peninsula. I have to say it's left me absolutely transformed. I'd already been reading the history, of course, and delving into the archives and reading people's stories of people who have been to the Antarctic in previous years over the last century or so. But when I actually personally experienced it, I had one of those moments of it's hard to describe. It's sort of coming out somehow out of the human experience to go to that region. It's so unlike Australia. And yet, as you say, they're both deserts. So in a funny way, there was a sort of a sense of a connection with the continent, even though we're such a long way away and it is such a vastly hostile and remote continent.
That connection between the deserts was well expressed by Sid Nolan, who Barry sent down there, didn't he, as a sort of to paint the landscape.
He did. That was in the 1960s. Sidney Nolan was always, as you know, intrigued by the idea of the desert landscape and the human frailty and of the explorers who went into that landscape. So when he went to Antarctica, he actually probably took a little bit of that sort of thinking with him. But what he actually said was that when he was expecting, what he was expecting to see was a flat, enormous paddock, I guess a bit like a sheep paddock, but what he found instead was a majestic kind of great continent. And he talked about it as instilling in him a mixture of fear and awe. And I think that actually really encapsulates the nature of the Antarctic landscape. In fact, many, many people have talked about that. Even today, there's still that incredible sense of being in the presence of a landscape that's almost alive, and yet it's such a hostile and alien place.
I think it's time to remind the listener about the exploitation of the region, and I'm thinking not only of whaling, but the decimation of the fur seals, and also the killing of penguins, which people probably don't know about.
That's true. It has been a region, certainly the waters around Antarctica, the Southern Ocean, are incredibly fertile, and as a result of the sea ice and the upwellings of nutrients from the deep, this region attracts, as you say, penguins, seals, bird life, and these are creatures that inhabit this ecosystem. It's a really diverse and very, very rich place. So it attracted the early sealers. In fact, right back when James Cook first went to the Antarctic, tried to find this unknown great southern land, and he didn't actually see the continent, but he certainly discovered some of the sub-Antarctic islands and reached the ice barrier that's now known as the Ross Ice Shelf. He recorded seeing so many creatures along the way. And, of course, that was at the time when sealers were active in the northern seas of the world, and also whaling eventually also became commercially profitable. And so these sealers and whalers started descending in large numbers, many of which ended up sailing from places like Hobart in Tasmania, because these were ports that were closer to Antarctica. And so there's a lot of there's a long history of exploitation in this region. In fact, whaling was still very much a commercially viable, active industry, even at the turn of the 20th century when Douglas Mawson first went down to the continent.
I want to hold Mawson just for a minute, Joy. But what the hell were they killing so many penguins for?
Well, penguins, as it turned out, were quite useful for their oil, helping the sealers to stoke up their fires. I know it sounds absolutely terrible today, and I can't imagine it myself. But they used digesters to put the penguins in to burn them so that their oil would burn and create heat sufficient to be able to melt the blubber of the seals that they were catching. These are the elephant seals, which have enormous amounts of oil stored in their blubber. The oil at that time, and we're talking here late 19th, early 20th century, was when was still being used. Well, it was in great demand in the Northern Hemisphere in the machines of industry, if you like. And so the penguins were sadly part of that whole process of industrialization that was occurring right down in the very southernmost part of the world, a long way from the industry of the Northern Hemisphere, but that's where a lot of the products from the southern region went.
Now let us celebrate the contribution of Mawson, because we have an expedition led by a scientist.
That's right. Well, Mawson, of course, had previously been to Antarctica with Ernest Shackleton on the Nimrod expedition in about 1907, and he had been a young student geologist, and he was invited by his supervisor, Edgeworth David, also a geologist. So he had already experienced Antarctica, but the big expedition that he led, the first Australian-led expedition, was in 1911-14. And that was an incredibly important part of Australia's Antarctic history. That's really where, as a scientist, Mawson was not just there to put a flag in the ice and claim it in the name of the British Empire, but to actually undertake of quite an intensive scientific program. So whilst there's a lot of stories around Mawson and his sledging journeys, and of course the fateful journey on which two of his men died, the larger story is one about really laying the groundwork for Australia's incredibly long and very close relationship with Antarctic science.
It has to be said that whilst he was inspirational in many levels, he was also, of course, interested in the mineral potential.
Yes, indeed. As a geologist, he was intrigued by the idea of there being mineral resources in Antarctica. In fact, you know, a lot of that early exploration in Antarctica was very much driven by not just by scientific curiosity, but by their desire to establish whether there were profitable resources to be exploited, and indeed to stake claims for sovereignty, to actually claim territory in this, what was then a very, you know, almost an unknown continent, the final continent to be explored. So yes, there was always that, you know, science always went hand in hand, right through until much later in the 20th century, with this idea of nationalistic, you know, territory claiming. But certainly over the 20th century, things really shifted. And so as we come into the more recent decades, the scientific program that Australia has conducted well and extensively over the century has now become, if you like, a more international enterprise.
We'll come back to that a little later. Yeah, for sure. Just for a moment, take us to Macquarie Island, and because its history is particularly fascinating.
It really is. Macquarie Island is, of course, about halfway between New Zealand and Antarctica. Douglas Mawson went there during his first expedition, the Australasian Antarctic Expedition, firstly to establish a temporary base there with the idea of being able to establish a radio link between Antarctica and Australia using Macquarie Island as a relay station. So his first encounter with Macquarie Island was at the time when there was a thriving penguin oil distilling business being undertaken. He was dismayed by this. He actually, despite his interest in finding mineral resources, he was actually really disturbed at the way in which the wildlife in around Macquarie Island was being exploited.
He really wanted to protect it, didn't he? And he must be happy looking down from heaven to see that it's now a UN World Heritage Site.
That's right. Look, he would be absolutely thrilled. And, of course, that was one of the great achievements was in terms of conservation, a very early achievement, that by the 1930s he had managed to persuade the Australian government. Indeed, it was the Tasmanian government that assumed responsibility for managing Macquarie Island, partly because of its wildlife, but also because, as a geologist, he understood that it was significant as a portion of the Earth's crust that comes up through the ocean and has been discovered to be, you know, incredibly rare in the sort of rocky outcrop that it is in the midst of the wild Southern Ocean. So I think the interesting thing about Macquarie Island is that it was recognised very early as for its significance, and Australia ultimately established a research station on the island, which operates today, that science continues.
It's interesting, isn't it, that there were so many scientific questions to be dealt with, the influence of weather on Australian weather, the fascination with the magnetic pull of the Southern Pole.
Yes, indeed. So through the 19th century, there was something called the Magnetic Crusade in the Northern Hemisphere, where early, they wouldn't have been called scientists in those days so much as natural historians and various people are interested in the way in which the magnetic forces of the Earth influenced particularly navigation, because that had a big influence on whether sailors could actually work out where they were in the ocean. So the Magnetic Crusade was something that Australia, well, as British colonies in the 19th century, was very much involved with. There were quite a few observatories actually established in Australia. But the that history is very interesting, I think, in the way that Australia contributed to that understanding of the role of Antarctica in the weather and the climate systems, as well as the magnetic interactions with the Earth's atmosphere.
I've mentioned that Macquarie Island is now a World Heritage Area and managed, would you believe, dear listeners, by Tasmanian Parks and Wildlife. But we have three bases, don't we? There's Mawson and Davis and Casey. What are the differences?
Correct. Well, they all have, they're all part of, part of the permanent research station network in Antarctica. I believe there's about 70 stations now of different countries. Around 29 countries have stations, permanent research stations. The Australia's three permanent research stations were established quite early in the 1950s and 60s. And a lot of that was around having a permanent presence, or at least a permanent station presence. People don't actually live there permanently, I should hesitate to add, because nobody lives in Antarctica. But the scientists, primarily scientists who are on these, who go to these stations annually, now are capable of staying, or certainly with the stations being established with all the facilities that are needed, they're able to stay there for a full 12 months and study various aspects of the Antarctic landscape over summer and winter.
Joy, it was a very macho boys' club. I remember that originally women were banned from going, and things change, fortunately.
That's right. It definitely was a male domain. In fact, interestingly, when I was looking at doing the research for this book and looking at the archives, most of it really related to that earlier period when there were few women's voices, I guess, in this history. And so one of the things I was interested in was talking about that early phase when there were major transition of the culture of the stations, if you like, was occurring. And one of the big issues, of course, when women started to felt their, make their presence felt, wanted to be in part of the Antarctic program in the 1970s and 80s, was that there was a lot of opposition, because I think some of the men on the station felt, and not all of them, but some felt that, it meant they'd have to watch their behaviour and, take down the girly posters and things like that. But actually the women who did start to go to the Antarctic over the, particularly during the 80s, were really there on their merits, and they were very much part of the team as scientists, as doctors, as station leaders. And there's some amazing stories about some of those pioneering women. But when I interviewed a few of the women to introduce some of the more recent voices, if you like, I just found some amazing stories of the sort of scientific research that they're doing. One woman in particular I just wanted to mention, Dr. Barbara Wernecki, who's still actively researching with the Antarctic Division. She's an emperor penguin specialist, and she was the first woman to spend winter out on the sea ice researching and monitoring and measuring and observing the life cycle of emperor penguins, which, of course, are the most remarkable bird, because they are the only creature that breeds in the middle of winter in the middle of the Antarctic. It's just the most incredible story.
Joy, I mentioned at the outset my fascination with the vent effects, but I have an equal interest in the ice cores, those wonderful luminous pieces of ice that tell us so much about the past and, I guess, the future.
Absolutely. Ice core drilling really began in earnest in the 1980s when scientists started to understand that they needed to be able to find out the past history of climate change, if you like. They were looking back through deep time. There was concern about carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, and glaciologists really started to shift their attention from the surface of the ice sheet to understanding what the depths of the ice sheet could tell them. So one of the stories I tell is about ice core drilling in what's called the Law Dome, named after Philip Law, who was the first director of Australia's Antarctic program. In 2008, a team of Australians were drilling it right down into the ice, 1,200 metres into the ice, and they managed to extract a climate record, if you like, an archive of 80,000 years of what the climate looked like over 80,000 years, and particularly in the last 1,000 years, they found a direct correlation between heavy snowfalls in Antarctica and measuring them against records that have been kept only in the last 100 years in Western Australia, the incidence of prolonged drought. So they were able to find evidence that directly linked what was going on in Antarctica with the climate in Australia. And then they started to read these capsules, if you like, these long cores, very, very long cylindrical cores, which captured ice, and within the ice was air bubbles, which effectively were time capsules of the past atmosphere and, you know, sediments from volcano eruptions and things like that, a bit like tree rings.
They so also, I recall, contained evidence of the Romans beginning to smelt bronze. I mean, they picked up almost everything.
Absolutely. They are an incredible, as I say, I like to think of them as tree rings because that's sort of people know what they look like and the idea that you can read what happened in deep time, if you like. So the importance of this, though, is that what the scientists are now doing, and in fact, right now they're preparing to drill for million years. So they want to look at the last million years to see what the climate variation has been and why the ice ages have changed in their intervals. They've apparently slowed down over several hundred thousand years. So I think it's fascinating and it's so crucial for what, for understanding and, in fact, trying to predict future changes in the climate.
Joy, you've made a magical contribution to our little program. I've been talking to Joy McCann, environmental historian and author of Icebound, the Australian story of Antarctica, published by the National Library of Australia.
Getting in touch with ABCRN is easy. Join the conversation live using the ABC Listen app's call and text features.